Thank you, Mr. Nias. He introduced me for my number one speech. Start all over again. It's good to see all of you here today. What a wonderful facility you have here. It just seems to be the right size for this group. Beverly, my wife, and I are very, very happy to be here. This is my first time in Edmonton in 51 years. And also, before I go further, I wanted to welcome all the audience on the cybercast. We also have a cybercast in our Lafayette congregation, and we have people from many different places around the country, even overseas, that sometimes check into us. So all of you who are looking at us on the cybercast and listening to us, welcome to you. We have been graciously hosted by Bob and Valerie Barrett, who are very special people to us. We met them for the first time at the Feast of Tabernacles in Brno in 1989. That was the second time we went to Brno for the feast. And it immediately struck a friendship. It was a very, very special relationship that we've had with them ever since. We've just been able to share a lot of things almost from the very beginning, heart to heart, and they've remained our friends since. As I mentioned, I had been to Edmonton 51 years ago, and part of the reason that I came was partially is because I'm on the Council of Elders. We're able to take a certain amount of travel per year, and so I wanted to go this year, basically, because I wanted to see the Barrents, the Edmonton Church, but also because there's a family that lives here, a Ukrainian family, that were very close to my parents. My parents were refugees in World War II. They were both slave laborers that the Germans took from Ukraine to Germany to work. My mother was 16 years old. The Germans in the Barbarossa operation came into the villages and took one teenager from every home and put them on trains to work in factories in Germany. My mother was from Eastern Ukraine. My father was from Western Ukraine. Just before the end of the war, my parents got to know each other, and they became friends, and this is some of the questions that I want answered, became friends with these people who live here in Edmonton. They were both young couples, and as the war came to an end, it was expected for all these people to return back home to the Soviet Union, or Ukraine, specifically for my parents. But they noticed that the Russians were treating them very badly. They looked upon them as traitors, as those who had gone to Germany to work for the Germans, the enemy, and treated them like traitors. My parents, along with this couple, then escaped from this group that was being herded back to the Soviet Union and ended up in the British zone in Germany and lived in a displaced persons camp, a DP camp, for almost 5 years. That's where I was born. My parents were married at the end of the war in 1945. I was born in 1947, and we were refugees. And my parents looked everywhere in the world to find a home. Australia, Brazil, where many Ukrainians went to, Canada. And they finally found a professor at the University of Minnesota, a Ukrainian professor who sponsored them, and they came to Minnesota in 1949. This other couple, they're very good friends, ended up going to Edmonton, Canada, where they live to this very day. My parents both died young. My father died when I was a freshman at Ambassador College in 1967. He was 42 years old. And my mother died almost 19 years ago, or just actually a little more than 19 years ago. And in a way, I haven't gotten the full story about their escape, about what happened. My parents used to talk about these things a lot, but I never really fully had the story. And I've always wanted to visit their friends in Edmonton, Canada, to get the story straight, because there's a few things about their relationship, about their escape, about how they escaped from the Russians exactly. They're living in the displaced persons camp that would have always been interesting. They came to visit us in Minnesota. My mother took me when I was just 3 or 4 years old and my younger brother on a bus from Minneapolis to Edmonton back in 1952. And that's when still some of the major U.S. highways were gravel. And I remember very well riding on gravel on US 10 for miles after miles after miles. One direction we went across Montana, and the other direction back through the Canadian prairies, through Saskatchewan. So this is, again, for me, a very, very interesting and time when I want to visit our family. Also, tomorrow is the 12th anniversary of Ukraine's independence, and I guess there's some big doings here in the city of Edmonton, so we'll be, I guess, somehow go to that. But we'll be with these people who are getting up in age. They're 78 years old, and that's how old my parents would have been if they would have lived, and that's what we will be doing. Also, we had the opportunity when we were here to visit, be guests of Dan and Fern Barrent at their home, and met for the first time Rick and his wife, oh, forget his name just very quickly, Heather, that's what it was, yes, Barrent, and that was good. Partially one reason, too, that we wanted to do is, Mr. Barrent had said to talk about this, is that we have done some humanitarian work with the church, and also side by side with the church in helping our brethren and to help other people in the world. And we have grown, as almost not knowing where we're going exactly, but we've grown to where we've done some very interesting and very successful projects in helping people around the world. And there have been more and more Canadians that have shown an interest in this. And in order to make their help more viable, because we've had donations of equipment and wheelchairs and surgical instruments and so forth from people that we cannot give receipts for. And so we have wanted to register Life Nets, which we have operated in the United States now for 4 years in Canada. So we hope to be able to have a mailing address here working with the Barrents on that project. But Mr. Barrent mentioned to me, oh, but before I get to that, there's also one more thing I wanted to mention. I have written down here to thank Canada for Tim Hortons. I don't know what it is, but I just love Tim Hortons, and I come inside of Tim Hortons, I just feel at home, you know, the coffee and the Nanaimo bars, everything. I mean, everything is just, makes my life fulfilled. But I wrote that in my notes and I forgot to mention, I'm sorry. But working with the Council of Elders, and people have questions about, you know, some things that we do. I'm just very happy to say, since I have been with the United Church of God from the beginning and the helping in the formation of the United Church of God, I have been one of the original board members and have been on the council now for almost from the very beginning. Just want to say that God has blessed His people and bless those who have wanted to remain true to the beliefs that we would have and have given our lives for. And God has provided us a home. Having people in it, of course, nothing is perfect, and people are people. But God has blessed the United Church of God overall in a wonderful way, not only to where we are able to be free about the things that we believe, but also have developed a process by which that cannot be taken away by any one person. I would say that if there's anything that generalizes where we're at, I feel that there's a stability and identity that has come into the United Church of God, especially in the last several years, that is very heartwarming to me in seeing the development of, to me, some of the signs of where we're going as far as growth are those who have not only subscribe to the magazine, which in many cases is the entry point for people, but also those who have read our basic literature, and for those who have completed the correspondence course, those who have gone beyond the correspondence course, and those who still hang on the fringes. We have 2,500 people that have finished the correspondence course, have listened to tapes a year after that, who still are just out there waiting and still haven't made the commitment to become part of the church. Every year we have approximately 60, 70 people that are brand new people that come in that have had no background at all with the churches, the church that we had been associated before, or any other Sabbatarian groups. And that's a number that I want to see continually growing. But we're having this pool of people that have been increasing, and those that have wanted to continue with what we have, wanted to know more, but have not committed themselves to the church. And that's the group that we want to continue working with and educating them. But there is a stability to the United Church of God. There's an identity. We're here to stay. We're a church that is respected. And even when we had others come and tour our home office, people have said, you know, we would really like to have what you have. And to me, that was a great compliment. As far as the distribution of literature, as far as the ministers that we have scattered throughout churches, there are other churches, but they oftentimes have pastors that serve an area that's just beyond the ability to be able to be served. And one of the greatest strengths of the United Church of God is the fact that we have ministers in most churches, or that have access to brethren in most places. What I'll do is I'll have a few things to say about some of our humanitarian efforts, but I'll open it up to a few questions just as part of this first session, because you may have a question that's burning on your mind that I can answer very quickly. And I guess afterwards we'll have coffee and we can even talk a little bit further before I give the sermon. But I wanted to tell you about an experience in my life that started in 1996. Actually, in 1995, I met at the Feast of Tabernacles in the United Kingdom a local elder. And he had given the sermonette that day, and at the minister's dinner, he sat across the table from Bev and me at the dinner. And he identified himself as a surgeon who was about to retire. His name was Morris Frohn. And he said that he had just received a journal, and since his specialty was thyroid and endocrine problems, and he was a surgeon, he said that the level of thyroid cancer in Ukraine has increased by a factor of 10, not 10%, but 10 times over. And he said, I find this to be appalling, and it's in the Chernobyl area. And I said, oh, well, I've gone to Ukraine many times, and you know, of course I haven't gone in some time, and we just talked at the feast. And he said, why don't we go there together? I'm not sure who said it. Could have been him, could have been me. Why don't we go over together? And so we chatted and just said, yeah, let's do that. Of course, we thought that that's just talk at dinner, you know, and you won't really do it. He said, I might have some people who know doctors in the Chernobyl area. Well, I found out very quickly that you're not normally welcome in that area unless you have something that you can bring to that area. As doctors have said that they have invited people to come over, and many people come over and see the appalling conditions and say, you know, we'll do something about this. And then when they return home, they forget, they can't deliver, and it's quickly forgotten. And he said, if you do come over, we want you to help us because our conditions are very, very grim. And we found that we were rejected and not given an invitation. But then through another one of his patients, he was able to get to an agency that worked with some doctors who were about to open a new center for rehabilitation. And sure enough, in April of 1996, Morris Frohn and I decided together, not knowing each other very well, to go to Ukraine. And we saw some horrible, appalling conditions in hospitals, clinics, polyclinics, and so forth. And Morris said, I'm going to do something about this. And I said, you know, I'd like to do something about this, but I've never, you know, how do I get things? I mean, they want medicine, they want equipment, they want clothing, they want blankets, they want all types of things. You know, how in the world do we, first of all, acquire these things, but worse, how do we get these things over to these areas? And I just prayed. I said, God, help me help these people. And honestly, I didn't know where this would lead. Well, returning back to the United States, I found that my sister had been involved in shipping large amounts of aid overseas through the government. And I talked to her about these things. She said, oh, well, let's see if we could be able to help out. And before long, through some of the groups that she worked with, they were able to put 10 tons of aid together. Some of it was not really high quality. A lot of it was, you know, a lot of old used clothes. But we did get a sizable amount of things over to Ukraine. And it was very exciting, very exhilarating that a large amount of aid for virtually no cost, as far as out-of-pocket expense, was able to be moved because there are other people around that want to help out but don't know really how to help. They're the people that are able to ship things but don't have the things. And you find there's a whole network of people that want to do different things. There's some people that just enjoy going into stores and talking store owners out of excess items. They don't even care where it goes. And so I found that after a couple of containers, there was another crisis in Ukraine with Sabbatarian refugees in Central Asia who were being persecuted by Muslims. We were able to help them with a container through this similar government program. Then it dawned on me that, you know, why not try to set up some type of method to help our needy brethren in different parts of the world? And so then I began to ask around. The most obvious person to ask was Leon Walker. And I asked him, he's the manager of our brethren, or the director of the Latin work. I said, is there anything that, you know, is a needy thing right now that could be done to help our brethren in whatever countries you serve? And the first thing that he said was kind of strange. He said, our brethren in Guatemala, probably a good place to start, need concrete floors in their homes. Concrete floors, I mean, you know, it's not food, it's not clothing, concrete floors. But I found out that one of the things that was very much needed in about 15 members' homes was the fact that they lived on dirt and they needed a floor. And in those countries, there are parasites, there are, you know, a lot of unsanitary things that develop as a result of living on dirt. And children's health and families' health is greatly degraded. And so we were able to collect some money, and lo and behold, we were able to have three or four concrete floors poured by their spokesman's club. But we provided the cost of materials. Then that led to looking at some other conditions down there where we found that in some of our homes in Central America, nine people lived in one room. Nine people, grandma, great-grandma, you know, mom, the kids. And so this is deplorable, these conditions. And so we started a program of helping with habitat, of building on an extra room or two. Cost oftentimes would be $100 or $200. You know, very nominal cost. Then Mr. Walker asked me if we could help out with scholarships and help some of our young people in these countries go to university. Some of the countries, in some areas, unemployment runs as high as 75%. It means only one person in four works. In El Salvador, for example, the monthly wage, a good monthly wage, is $200. In Guatemala, it's maybe $140 US. And if you don't have an education, you're at the horrible mercy of a terrible economy. But if you have an education and can be an accountant, if you can be a dentist, which some of our people have become, if you can be an architect or have other professions, you're way ahead. You have an advantage. And you face the labor market with something to offer for it. And so we started a scholarship program in El Salvador that's expanded to Guatemala, to Mexico, to Colombia, Peru, and Chile. And right now we help 51 students with just paying their tuition at university. And you cannot believe the letters of gratitude that come from these young people in these countries that say, you have given us a life. You've given us some, you've given us hope. You make me proud to be a member of the United Church of God because now I feel like I can contribute to our church, I can contribute to society, and I am ready. We also, through dentists, were able to send an entire dental office to El Salvador. And two of our students graduated from dental school and now have a two-chair dental office. And even their mentors and their teachers said, you are 5-6 years ahead of people in our society, even dentists that graduate. That dental office cost us zero. It was through the wife of a local elder in central Pennsylvania, who's a dentist, local elder, that was able to find a dentist who was retiring. We packed his things, and we sent them to Central America. This led to our working in Africa, and I won't belabor you with all the process, but it's been very exciting to us. Bev and I were in Zimbabwe for the feast, and our only two brethren from Malawi came down by bus to Zimbabwe, And they were telling us about the deplorable health conditions in their country. And they both operated a clinic. And they told us the fact that they operated this clinic, this health center. And he was a practitioner, and she was a midwife. Sounded like a big, big thing. We started shipping them a few items of medicine. And we had a few ministers that were interested, or one minister in particular who was very interested in helping out. And we shipped just a regular box of medicine, sort of on an irregular basis. Well, that has grown now to where we ship the equivalent value of the U.S., which would probably be less than half Canadian, because Canadian medicine is cheaper, of $125,000 a year worth of medicine that costs us only $5,000. And we do this on a regular quarterly basis, and we provide our brethren, and we provide their communities with the antibiotics and anti-malaria medicines that they need. This has been very exhilarating to us, that we've been able to make a difference, and it's really cost us very little. We've been able to network with other agencies, we've been able to work with the government, we've been able to work with other medical missionary groups who have given us and have just opened their warehouses to us and say, take what you need, and we will be happy to help you out. But this brought me to a broader look as to our helping out people in needy areas. I feel that the responsibility of the church primarily is to preach the gospel. And people sometimes say, well, where does, you know, good works fit into what we're doing? Well, they fit in very, very strongly and in a very, very direct way. First of all, in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 17, we read, whosoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need. Now, in many ways, I had worked in church administration and had traveled around the world many times. But honestly, I didn't really see some of the needs. I wasn't looking for the needs. I didn't think it was my duty to deal with some of the needs in our international areas, in our developing nations. But when you take a look as to how we live and what can be done, and of course there are objections. Objections such as, will the aid really get to the people? Or is it our mission or job to do that? Are we taking money away from preaching the gospel? We've been able to override every single one of these concerns and have been able to do something very, very effective. But whosoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? Is the question, a rhetorical question. It doesn't. If you see a brother who's in need, if you see a person in Malawi who's making only $50 a month, or you see a village in Zambia where a number of children die every year because of malaria or other diseases that could be very quickly dealt with some simple medicine, how can we shut up our heart to that? With a few pennies, with a few dollars of support, we're able to make a difference. Our brethren in central Zambia over 5 years ago lost their entire herd of cattle. This provided them with draft power to pull the plows, and this provided them with milk protein for their children. These cattle died all of a sudden in a very short order due to a disease called corridor disease spread by wild buffalo. And they had been using techniques and grazing that were hundreds, maybe thousands of years old, you know, where they grazed, the entire community grazes all their cattle together, and then the buffalo come in from the bush and carry ticks that carry medicine. Buffalo end up okay, but the cattle all dies. And we were able to, for a very small amount, been able to provide them with a new herd, 24 heifers, a couple of bulls, and we just had our first calves born here in the month of May. And this cattle has provided them the things that they have needed. But they had their wives, they had their children pulling plows. I thought, well, if we didn't do something about it, who would? Now, we do need to notice our brother in need and be able to help out. Our responsibility is to do good, and to do good to all, especially to the household of God, as it reads in the 10th verse of the 6th chapter of Galatians. Since that time, we've organized and have been able to send medicine on a regular basis, have been able to provide computers overseas. We have sent over quite a bit of clothing and even food to our areas that are in either famine or drought conditions, as Malawi has been. We sent over 6 tons of food last year, and we've been able to provide them with food by having them purchase it in neighboring countries of recent time. We've been able to restore cattle. We've been able to build 2 clinics in Malawi, both run by church members. And one clinic is also the place where the church meets. They especially made their waiting room large so it could house a congregation of about 40, 50 people. We've been able to install a dental clinic, been able to provide scholarships, habitat, and in Central America, we've been able to help some of our brethren open little businesses. We've been able to help some of our ladies have a stall in a marketplace. And for a cost of $100 to $150, we've been able to get whatever license she needed and get her started and to be a vendor. Well, she couldn't do this before, and she was at the mercy of family. Now she can do something constructive. We've been able to provide 4 sewing machines for 4 different ladies who now have a business in their home, making clothing and selling it. One of our big success stories was we started a woman who was a widow. Her husband had been murdered a few years ago, and she had young children. And she worked at a factory, had come home very late, made a very small amount. We were able to actually put in a grocery store in her home. She was on a street, and she's able to sell right out of her home through windows with bars on it, and be able to sell eggs, and it's like a convenience store. And she now has done so well that she's expanding her business at her own expense. We got her started, we got her going, but now she lives at home and operates this little grocery store right from her home. This has been a big success story. We've done this now in several cases. So this livelihood development has truly been very, very successful. And we've been very glad to do it. So right now what we want to do is I'll have on the information table one of the brochures here that we have showing the projects that we do and our last two newsletters that we call Lifelines. This last one that we just sent out a few weeks ago talks about a well that we built on a church member's property in Malawi. Now in this particular case, this little village, or it's actually a settlement, women carried 20-liter jugs on their head and walked 2 miles one direction and 2 miles back with water every day. And what we've been able to do is to build a well on a member's property to where the entire settlement comes to that well, and they're just only a few hundred feet away from that, and have fresh water. This sends a message of we do care for those people, we do care for our own, and our own are able to help others. And the simple thing like fresh water. And we had the Akron Church, Akron, Ohio Church, do a fundraiser to build this well. And what they did, most of the money was collected by asking one of the men in the church that if we collected $200, would you shave your beard? And he's been in church for over 25 years. Everybody knows him having a beard. Nobody knows him without a beard. And he says, oh, $200, I'm going to shave off my beard and change my look. Well, okay. And they had an auction to see how high they could get this number to, and actually $1,100 was collected to shave Frank Edwards' beard. Clyde Kylo was there for the variety show that was done on that day. This was in December. They had a variety show, they had a spaghetti dinner, and they had for the last act of the evening the shaving of Frank Edwards' beard. It was done by a nurse, And it was done to the music of 2001 Space Odyssey with colored lights. It was a big, 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 big event. And then the teenagers from three different churches were very instrumental in organizing this and asked us if we could name the well the Frank Edwards Well. So I called Bill Johns in South Africa and had him make a sign. And it's right there at the well, the Frank Edwards Well. And it's operating. We're just so happy to see it functioning. So I'll put out these newsletters. I'll put out the annual report, we call it. And you can take a look at some of the projects that we have, and we want to be able to help out from Canada. Working with the Barents, who are both medical doctors, they already have helped us with people in Peru, but we need to get a little bit more organized here in this area. Okay, are there any questions? Yes, sir.
There's a website you can access
that? Yes, lifenets.org. LIFENETS.org. You can see all the projects that we have. I might say that a lot of our support is from outside the church. We have received grants from hospitals, from corporations. People oftentimes at work have their company match their contribution. And so we work as a public charity in the United States. But much of the aid that we have goes either directly to brethren, or it goes to brethren to help others in their community, which actually brings another element of passing on the gift. Our program for cattle is called Pass on the Gift, where the first animal born from each of the animals will be going to a neighbor in the community. They will be able to keep all the calves after that. But in order for the community to benefit from this and not look upon these as people who are specially favored by Americans or people from far away, they also will benefit. And of course, our people will benefit as well. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Why would you have kept it so much out of the church?
Actually, it's very much in the church. Our entire group, our board is composed of mostly local church elders, and our chairman is a local elder in our congregation, Tom Piney. We work with Leon Walker. We work with Andre Van Belkom in South Africa. I find that by being just one step away from the church and the way this operates, we're able to get a lot of support from outside the church as well. So that is one of the big benefits in that way. The church, however, is starting its own Good Works program, where congregations can also sponsor different projects. And we want to work together. Things that we do well, we will continue to do well. Things that maybe local congregations would like to sponsor, for example, one church may want to sponsor a well, another well in Malawi, or would like to buy a few bicycles for our brethren in Zambia, or buy a few more calves. Well, they can sponsor those projects on their own. Does that answer your question? Administration. With us, 96 cents out of every dollar goes directly for programs. And we have basically all volunteers, who work. And the biggest benefits we have is that not only do we work on this end, we work directly with people we know on the other end. And who are the people on the other end? They are our ministers who know the needs of the brethren in those areas. We work with people whom we trust, who we know, who we visited. My wife and I will be going to Malawi for the Feast of Tabernacles. And one of the purposes is to keep the feast, but the other is we want to see our clinics. We want to see how they're doing. We want to see that well. We want to talk to the people. We want to assess other needs and to bring that information back to the United States. Okay. Yes, ma'am. I see he had the first question here, but he's declined. Okay. About the Sabbatarians, I'm not sure if I fully understand the question. We have been working with Sabbatarians in Ukraine since 1991, and our first trip there was in 1992, and we had an ambassador foundation and an ambassador college project there in 1994. We have worked with these people as friends. We've never talked about uniting with them. I'm glad we didn't, because that was back under Worldwide Church of God. And in one sense, you know, to maybe answer a little bit more of your question, I think, is that we want to continue staying friends. I feel like if we try to merge our organizations together, there are just too many cultural differences. There are just too many things that we have to iron out that are so minor. For example, they don't drink alcohol. You know, we do. Well, I'd hate to have everything hung up, you know, just on points like this. They believe you shouldn't dance, you know. Well, we do. And yet, doctrinally, on other issues, as far as, you know, the nature of God, not keeping, you know, the Roman holidays like Christmas, the understanding of the Sabbath, and so forth, we're right down the line with them. And I would prefer us to have to be friends and be able to just skirt around the minor issues than to, you know, have unpleasant, you know, develop it that way. And so I find that that works very well. The Sabbatarians help us in different ways. One of the Sabbatarians is a printer in Western Ukraine, and he has printed our literature. In fact, he printed our material that is distributed in Estonia. And he prints it in Western Ukraine and just sends it a short distance. For one thing, it's a lot cheaper, and it's printed locally. It's just as good as our literature, but they help out that way. So they feel like they have a part in the things that we do, and we maintain a decent relationship with them. Yes?
So they did attend with us for a while when the first came.
Right. When the first Sabbatarians came to Florida, there was a group of about 15 of them, which included their leader. This was the very first grouping that came over in 1990. They were looking for a Sabbatarian church. And their translator, and the woman who was helping them get, you know, things set up, said, you know, yeah, there is a group here. Because she was a prospective member with Worldwide Church of God. So she directed them to the Worldwide Church of God pastor, who then called me. And after a certain amount of time, I came out to Florida and met with them. And they met with us for a number of years. In fact, they moved to North Carolina and attended there. But since that time, literally hundreds, I think probably a couple hundred more of them have come over. And so they have basically met themselves, by themselves. For one thing, the language. People who come over don't know English, and they met together. And so there's enough of them to where they have their own congregations and their services. And there are some cultural differences, too. Their services, while they have a certain similarity to our service, there's a lot more prayer, there's a lot more singing. You know, it's just different. And I feel like that's the way it should be for them. And, you know, we have a certain manner that we're accustomed to in our church, and this is good for us. But when I'm with them, I feel very brotherly. I speak in their churches. When I go to Portland, Oregon, or when I go to Ukraine, I feel very comfortable in being with them and consider them brothers. But they do things a little bit differently, and we're able to relate best in that manner. Okay, did I see another question here? Okay, well, it's been enjoyable for this first part, and I will then give the second half after Mr. Nias leads us in another hymn, and I believe there's also special music that I'm looking forward to hearing. Mr. Barron told me it was going to be good.